a sleepy southern town becomes a place of unimaginable horror as young girls begin disappearing. A cunning serial killer is on the loose, tormenting a family while evading capture. Until investigators could find a way to stop him, he would continue his hunt for more victims.
He was a predator, abducting girls and young women from their own front yards in broad daylight. He was a sadist, phoning one victim's family, taunting them, boosting, then dashing their hope. And he wouldn't stop until we stopped him. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. This serial killer, whoever he was, could pass unnoticed in society. Yet he craved the attention his crimes provided. Somewhere in this contradiction lay the key to his exposure.
May 31st, 1985. The afternoon sun over South Carolina roasted the town of Lexington to a blistering 100 degrees. Sherry Faye Smith had found relief from the heat at a pool party with her boyfriend and fellow high school seniors. She was looking forward to the carefree days between her final exams and graduation. All of summer and the rest of her life awaited the ambitious 17-year-old. She lived with her family in a quiet, rural community, a safe place tucked away on the edge of town. The Smiths' home sat on a generous lot of dense woods. The house was about 200 yards from the road. Sherry's dad, Robert Smith, served as a local pastor. This Friday afternoon, he worked at home in his second floor office. He looked up from his studies to see his daughter pulling into the driveway and stopping to get the mail. In the next few moments, life in Lexington, South Carolina changed forever. Expecting Sherry to walk in the house, Mr. Smith looked out the window again. He noticed her car remained near the mailbox, but she was nowhere in sight. Immediately, he felt something was odd. He decided to take a look. Sherry suffered from diabetes. With her blood sugar out of balance, she might become disoriented or incapacitated. When he arrived at the bottom of the driveway, Mr. Smith found Sherry's car still running and the door swung open.
Sherry?
But his daughter was gone. There was no response to his call.
Sherry!
His mind began to race as he imagined the possibilities. Could she be lying in the woods somewhere, unconscious or in shock?
Sherry!
He yelled louder as he grew more frantic with worry.
Sherry!
There was no sign of her anywhere. Sherry was gone. Mr. Smith immediately called for help. The assistant sheriff of Lexington County responded to the call. The distraught father explained that Sherry was not the type to just run off.
I'm not sure what happened, but how much time it had.
She was responsible, warm, and well-adjusted. Not the sort of teenager to run away. But the sheriff took nothing for granted. He questioned Smith about his relationship with his daughter. Today, more than a decade later, Assistant Sheriff Lewis McCarty vividly recalls his impressions of the Smith family during his first conversation with Sherry's father.
We discussed his daughter's grades, what kind of child she was. It was determined that there was no animosity between mother and father and daughter. The Smith family was a very, very close-knit family, a very religious family. You just had the sixth sense that they were extremely close, that this child would not have run away on her own.
The investigator couldn't shake the feeling that something bad had happened to Sherry Smith. And the same intuition told him it had nothing to do with her medical condition. Every minute that passed increased the likelihood that Sherry might never be found. Knowing this, the sheriff called for assistance, bypassing the 24-hour waiting period required before officially classifying an individual as a missing person. While waiting for the other officers to arrive, the sheriff and Robert Smith retraced Sherry's steps, careful not to destroy any possible evidence. But the naked eye search yielded nothing. They had to wait for more equipment and expertise. Within minutes, officers from the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, arrived at the Smith home. Investigators combed the scene, looking for tire tracks, foot impressions, or fingerprints. They found nothing. Knowing the next few hours were critical, the authorities assembled a task force and organized a massive ground search. The possibility of an abduction prompted a swift response. Crimes like this simply did not happen. Surrounding counties sent every available officer to help. Word of Sherry's disappearance spread quickly through the close-knit community of Lexington. Hundreds of local residents offered to participate in the search. Still, they found no trace of the young woman. Though there was no direct evidence that a federal crime had been committed, state investigators called on the expertise of the FBI. They wanted the Bureau to unofficially advise in the search and to assist in the investigation. Special Agent John Vollmer from the FBI's Columbia office was dispatched to the Smiths' house the next morning. The disappearance had even baffled the experts.
She was nowhere to be found. And she was not from a type of family background where that would readily indicate she'd run off with somebody. She was from a very stable, good family background, and they immediately thought obviously something had happened to her. But we had no idea at that point what.
The search urgently continued, with hundreds of volunteers and officers working around the clock. It was a daunting task. The heat and terrain hindered the hunt.
When you're talking about looking in a county of 500 square miles, it's almost like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's extremely difficult because you don't know where to begin and where to go.
Two long, hot days of searching passed, and still there was no sign of Sherry. It grew more and more likely that this was an abduction. Horrified that a crime like this could happen in their town, the residents of Lexington were gripped by fear. Children were not seen without their parents. No one went anywhere alone. With every hour that passed, investigators hoped there was still enough time to find Sherry unharmed. On June 3rd, 3 days after Sherry Fay's disappearance, at about 2:30 in the morning, a call disturbed the Smiths' restless sleep. Robert answered the phone. A voice he did not recognize asked for his wife, Hilda.
Hello?
The caller claimed to be Sherry's abductor.
Yes.
The captor apologized for taking Sherry and insisted that she would eventually be returned. He made clear this was not a ransom call. He told Hilda that she would receive a letter in the mail later that day.
Just tell us what you want.
He promised he'd call back and hung up.
He hung up.
Though a phone tap had been set up earlier, the call was too short to get a trace. SLED officers who were at the Smith home called Agent Vollmer immediately.
It really was unclear whether she was alive or dead. The caller was indicating that she was alive, that he would see that she was returned safely. And I think at that point, everyone was hopeful that he was truthful and that, in fact, she was not dead and would be returned to her home and family.
A letter hopefully containing clues to Sherry's whereabouts would be a welcome break. But first, they had to find out if the letter promised by the caller really did exist. Not wasting any time, they woke the town's postmaster and ordered him to open the post office before daybreak. Then they went to work, sifting letter by letter through the piles of outgoing mail.
Long envelope, something similar to this.
After a half hour, the postmaster found an envelope addressed to the Smiths. Carefully, they slipped it into an evidence bag and sent it to the SLED forensic labs for analysis. Inside the envelope, examiners found a two-page letter written on yellow legal paper. Their excitement melted into horror as they began reading the letter. It was entitled, Last Will and Testament. It began, I love you, Mommy, Daddy, Robert, Dawn, and Richard, and everyone else, and all other friends and relatives. My thoughts will always be with and in you. Casket closed. I am sorry if I ever disappointed you in any way. I only wanted to make you proud of me, because I have always been proud of my family. The letter ended with, all my love, always. Sharon, Sherry Fay, Smith. With the help of the Smith family, investigators confirmed that the handwriting was Sherry's. Lab examiners began the painstaking task of analyzing the letter, searching for prints, hairs, fibers, and other clues would take weeks. While investigators hoped the document might provide other valuable leads, they were alarmed by the letter's content.
We were shocked. We were concerned for her well-being. There were several phrases in the letter that she refers to. One would be casket closed. Is, you know, why would a child make a statement casket closed?
Sherry's fate was unclear. The abductor had all the answers. He had promised to call again. Until he did, the Smith family clung desperately to hope. Just days after Sherry Fay's disappearance, her abductor had called to taunt the family. Since then, agents and detectives set up a voice recorder in addition to the tap already on the Smith phone. Having the abductor's voice on tape would be invaluable. If the suspect called again, they would be ready. The wait was excruciating. At 8 o'clock on the evening of June 3rd, the phone rang.
Go ahead and answer it. Try to stay on the phone as long as possible.
Hello?
It was the voice from the night before. he spoke to Hilda.
Did you receive the letter today?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you know now that this is not a hoax call.
Yes, I know that.
Okay, listen real carefully. I got to hurry. I know these calls are being traced.
Is Sherry with you?
Sherry is now part of me. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, our souls are one now.
Your souls are one now with Sherry?
Yes, and we're trying to work this out. So please do what we ask.
The trace had been successful.
Go ahead, US-1.
The suspect had called from a phone booth about 20 miles away from the Smith home. A network of sheriff's deputies staking out the area raced to the scene, hoping to catch the caller still on the phone. But when they arrived, all they found was a phone dangling off the hook.
Area, any cars? Give me plates, any cars leaving the immediate area right now.
He had slipped away, leaving nothing behind, not even fingerprints.
I just missed him.
Sherry's older sister, Dawn, recollects the agonizing uncertainty.
I didn't really understand what was going on at the time. I didn't understand that he was a very sick person. I'd never dealt with anybody like that in my life. But I really believed that he was taking care of her and that there had to be some reason for the madness of Sherry being taken.
On the surface, the abductor's phone conversations revealed nothing about Sherry's whereabouts. However, for the FBI, the phone calls offered the first glimpse inside the mind of this twisted predator. It would be up to FBI profilers in the investigative support unit at Quantico, Virginia, to penetrate this criminal's mind. John Douglas pioneered behavioral profiling for the FBI. He and others developed the investigative tool from over 25 years of interviews with convicted killers, arsonists, rapists, and bombers.
Okay, good. When someone asks for a profile, what they're looking for are characteristics, which includes gender, includes age, race, sometimes body typing, educational level, occupational type.
To determine these characteristics, the profiler attempts to think like the killer. He tries to uncover his motivations. Examining every aspect of a crime reveals patterns of behavior. What emerges is a profile describing the type of person the killer will most likely be. After scrutinizing every detail of Sherry's abduction, Douglas generated a 22-point profile of the suspect. He painted the abductor as a white male, in his late 20s to early 30s, with above-average intelligence. He would most likely work as a blue-collar day laborer. Because it sounded as if the killer had electronically distorted his voice, he probably worked in electrical contracting. He would have a prior criminal record. Douglas also suggested he lived locally. The tone and content of his phone calls indicated he was an asocial obsessive compulsive. If the stress of everyday life became too great, he would break down. He would then feel compelled to compensate for his own inadequacies through violent actions.
He's the type of guy that feels like one grain of sand on a beach where there are billions and billions of grains of sand. He feels like nothing. He feels like a nobody. And how can this nobody, this personality, this person who's probably overweight, low self-esteem, doesn't unattractive, how can he become a somebody? He'll go after victims that there was no chance that he would ever come in contact with someone like a Sherry Faye Smith. And so for the first time in their life, they can be powerful.
On Wednesday, June 5th, the Smiths received another call. This time, he gave the family directions to where they would find Sherry.
Listen carefully. Take Highway 378 West to Traffic Circle. Turn left at White Frame Building. 6 feet beyond, we're waiting. God chose us.
Investigators raced to the location, hoping they might still find her alive. Six days after her mysterious disappearance, investigators found the body of Sherry Faye Smith.
When the Smith family received the call to the location of the body, we went immediately there, and our worst fears came true.
Sherry's body had been laid in the woods of Saluda County, some 17 miles from the home from which she vanished. Her abductor was now wanted for first-degree murder. A week of 100-degree heat had taken its toll. The body's advanced state of decay worked in the killer's favor. The medical examiner could not determine the exact cause and time of death. To John Douglas, the location and condition of the crime scene provided further insight into the suspect's mind.
He has some criminal sophistication, because I believe what he did is he waited for her to now go into advanced stages of decomposition, which would make it more difficult for law enforcement to determine cause and method of death in this state of decomposition.
The confirmation of Sherry's murder devastated the Lexington community. That Saturday, a crowd of 1,000 mourners attended a funeral service at the town's First Baptist Church. That evening, following Sherry's funeral, the killer could not resist inflicting more torment.
Well, may I speak to Mrs. Smith?
Sherry's Aunt Beverly answered the phone.
I want to speak to Dawn.
I'm sorry, she's not available either.
Beverly stalled him, hoping to gain valuable time for the phone trace.
Yeah, I have to go then if I can't talk to her.
But the suspect threatened to hang up if he couldn't immediately speak to Dawn.
Hello?
This thing got out of hand, and all I wanted to do was make love to Dawn. I've been watching her for a couple of weeks.
To who?
To Sherry. Dawn, I hope you and your family forgive me for this.
When you killed Sherry, was she at peace? She wasn't afraid or anything?
She was not. She was at peace. She knew that God was with her, and she was going to become an angel.
Overwhelmed with grief, Sherry's mother insisted on talking to her daughter's murderer.
Did you tell her you were going to kill her?
Yes, I did, and I gave her the choice, and she picked suffocation.
My God, how could you?
It did not escape the attention of the FBI and local investigators that the killer had mistakenly used Dawn's name when he spoke of Sherry. They braced themselves for the possibility that this killer might be turning his murderous obsession towards Dawn. But the suspect would make only one more call before falling ominously silent. Though he wasn't talking, they knew he was still out there, terrifying a community. And the profile predicted that if he killed once, he would kill again. In June 1985, FBI investigators continued to hunt the kidnapper and killer of 17-year-old Sherry Smith. While investigators focused on the Smith murder, the elusive predator pursued other plans. On Friday, June 14th, 2 weeks after Sherry's abduction, a man grabbed Deborah May Helmick from her front yard in Richland County as she played with her brother. She was just 9 years old. The child's screaming alerted a neighbor. But the woman was not fast enough. The abductor managed to slip away in broad daylight. Helmick's neighbor could only provide vague information. However, the general description of the suspect and his method appeared eerily similar to the man the FBI wanted for the murder of Sherry. Richland County sheriffs immediately contacted the task force in nearby Lexington.
Within moments of that abduction, we were aware of it and began to focus on that case also. We were pretty much in our minds. I think that everybody knew these two cases were connected.
For John Douglas, the case took on an even greater sense of urgency. Deborah Mae Helmick's fate seemed almost certain.
Once they get the urge, they're out looking for the preferential victim, but if they cannot find the victim of choice, they will go after whoever is available. And that was the case here with Deborah Mae Helmick.
News of the second abduction brought Douglas down from Quantico, Virginia to South Carolina. The FBI hoped they could find 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick before her young life was cut short. In the Smith case, the killer's phone calls had been a critical link for the investigators. It had been nearly a week since Deborah's disappearance, and they hadn't heard from him. To get him to call, Douglas devised a plan. With the help of the local media, he would set a trap.
And the way that
one key element of the plan placed Dawn Smith in jeopardy. Douglas had to ask the Smiths to put their other daughter at risk to catch Sherry's killer and hopefully find young Deborah. Dawn agreed.
A lot of times people thought we were twins. We looked a lot alike, and so they came up with this plan that if I were to answer the phone, maybe he would turn that fascination from Sherry to me. And if I could keep him on the phone talking long enough about Sherry, about himself, about anything to keep him on the phone, then they could trace the call and catch him.
Douglas's strategy centered around a memorial service for Sherry. Investigators promoted the service in the local press. The agents hoped the attention to his first victim would rekindle the killer's fascination with Dawn. Douglas needed something else to bait the trap, a personal item from Sherry's room. Based on experience, Douglas knew that sexual predators are often attracted to personal items of their victims. They want mementos that they can keep, even display as trophies. He noticed the koala bear. It was the mascot of the university she planned to attend in the fall.
This is going to work perfectly.
The day of the memorial service, plainclothed agents swarmed the grounds, hoping their suspect would visit the cemetery. As the family's minister delivered a eulogy, Dawn and her parents huddled close. Though Dawn had willingly volunteered to lure the killer to the trap, the danger it presented weighed on everyone's mind. There was no telling what the suspect might do.
The security around Dawn was heightened. We were extremely, extremely concerned about Dawn becoming a victim.
Then, as planned, Dawn placed some flowers and the koala bear on her sister's grave. Now all that was left to do was wait. Using Douglas's profile, FBI agents coached Dawn on how to handle the suspect when he called.
I was told to never be threatening, to never be harsh, to be real understanding and sympathetic and compassionate, and I was with him. And I think he liked that because he felt like he was very much in charge, which is something that he thrived on.
Several calls came to the Smith home following the memorial service. Not knowing if it was Sherry's killer, Dawn had to answer every one. Shortly after midnight, the phone at the Smith house rang again.
Hello?
I have a call to Dawn Smith from Sherry. Will you pick up the phone?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
As Douglas had hoped, the culprit took the bait. And as anticipated, the killer had turned his focus to Dawn.
You can't be protected all the time.
He made it clear to her that she was going to be his next victim.
You know, God wants you to join Cherry Faye. It's just a matter of time. This month.
Despite the threat, Dawn kept him on the line, enduring abuse from the man who murdered her sister, while officials traced the origin of the call.
Richland County?
Yeah. Okay, listen carefully. Go one north.
Then, before hanging up, the killer offered directions.
Turn right. Deborah May is waiting. God forgive us all.
Special Agent John Vollmer feared that the killer would not stop there.
Once he called about Deborah Helmick, then you're leading into the possibility that you now are dealing with a possible serial killer who has killed now at least two, you suspect, maybe others before, and may continue to kill others.
Despite Douglas's success at getting the suspect to call, no one had anticipated just how far away the killer would go to avoid detection. Tracing the call from outside the area took additional time. Again, the suspect left the phone booth moments before the authorities could reach him.
We were very, very close to catching him on a number of occasions, and it's almost as if he sensed this and began to move further in making his phone calls.
Other investigators followed the caller's directions. There, they found 9-year-old Deborah May Helmick murdered. The gamble had failed. With every missed opportunity, the probability of more victims increased. And now, Dawn was the most likely target. Investigators feared the killer would make an attempt to abduct her. An elusive serial killer had already killed two girls around Lexington, South Carolina. The slim amount of evidence frustrated FBI investigators as well as local law enforcement. But the forensic analysis was about to generate the biggest break in the investigation. The last will and testament of Sherry Smith was examined by Gail Heath, director of the questioned document section of the South Carolina Law Enforcement Labs. Using an ESDA machine, Heath hoped to find hard evidence. The ESDA, an acronym for electrostatic detection apparatus, can pick up images that are invisible to the naked eye. It works on the opposite principle of a printing press. Instead of coating raised letters with ink to create an image, the ESDA fills in the indentations on the document in question with graphite. When an imaging film similar to Saran Wrap is pulled tight over the document, a readable image comes through. After hours of examining the document, Heath found indented writing. It appeared to be a phone number and a name.
The particular name and phone number in question, we were able to bring up the entire area code, the first three numbers of the prefix, the next two numbers, the third number we were unsure of, and then we had the fourth number.
The name on the pad was Joe. From the area code, investigators determined the number was from Alabama. To fill in the missing digit, investigators called every combination of the phone number until they reached a party who had the same name as the one found on the legal pad. They finally made a match. The number belonged to a man named Joe Shepherd. Investigators scrutinized his phone records. They found that he had received a call from an address just outside of Lexington in Lake Murray, South Carolina. Either of these addresses could belong to the killer. Armed with the FBI profile, local police visited the Alabama address.
How you doing? You Mr. Shepherd?
They met Joe Shepherd. He didn't match the killer's profile. Even though he was not a suspect, he could still be an important link to the killer.
Hey, my parents are
police there. Had to find out the connection between him and the Lake Murray, South Carolina phone call. Shepard explained it came from his parents' home. South Carolina officers verified that the address belonged to Joe Shepard's parents, Ellis and Sharon Shepard. Investigators went to the Lake Murray address to question the residents. The house was just 2 miles from where police found the body of 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick. 10-4. They learned that Ellis worked as an electrician in home construction. It was a profession the FBI profile predicted. As the officers knocked on the door, a car pulled into the driveway. When investigators saw the Shepherds, they immediately felt they had hit another dead end. Besides Ellis Shepherd's profession, nothing else seemed to fit the profile. They questioned them anyway. The Shepherds told them that they had recently returned from a 6-week trip. The officers casually asked if the couple knew about the Smith and Helmick murders. With every question, the police noticed Mrs. Shepherd becoming more concerned. The Shepherds were beginning to suspect their house sitter, Larry Jean Bell. As they described Bell, elements of the profile fell into place. He was a white male, in his 30s, who lived with his parents. He sometimes assisted Ellis in home construction. Just days earlier, when the Shepherds returned from the vacation, Bell had picked them up from the airport. He talked to the Shepherds at length about the cases. He was closely following the news of the murders. It was more evidence of a meticulous mind and behavior consistent with the profile.
They said that he had saved the newspaper articles, told them all about the case in great detail from the airport back to their residence. Again, it was uncanny how much this profile was on track.
The detectives asked if they could see the inside of the house. Suspecting the killer had used a weapon to force Sherry Smith into the car, they asked Ellis Shepherd if he owned a gun. Shepherd led them to a drawer where he kept his revolver. To his surprise, the gun was gone.
Got a good idea.
The officers asked the couple to accompany them to the precinct. They wanted the Shepherds to listen to recordings of the killer's calls to the Smith family. The investigators needed to know if the voice on the recordings belonged to their house sitter.
For a couple of months, and then they'd find out I'm sane, and then I'd get tried and get sent to electric chair, put in prison, rest of my life. I'm not going to stay in prison, rest of my life.
Though the caller may have electronically altered his voice, to the Shepherds, it was clear that the man on the tape was their house sitter, Larry Jean Bell.
We were all extremely elated. We could not show any emotion, but we knew that we had the case at that point. We had our man.
The Shepherds told the police that they expected Bell to return to their home at 7:30 the next morning for work. Investigators staked out Bell's residence. This time, there was no way he could elude capture. Larry Jean Bell headed down the highway to the Shepherds. He failed to notice the unmarked police car following behind him. The officers radioed to another car waiting to cut him off at the approaching intersection. June 26, 1985, at 7:19 a.m., investigators finally trapped the elusive Larry Jean Bell. This time, it was the investigators who were one step ahead. Bell was arrested without resistance and taken to the precinct for questioning. With Bell now in custody, investigators still needed to build an airtight case to make sure he would never be free to kill again. Combining hard forensic evidence with the FBI profile, South Carolina police arrested Larry Jean Bell on suspicion of kidnapping and murder. But now they had to prove beyond any doubt that he was indeed the killer of Sherry Smith and Deborah Mae Helmer. It was up to Lexington County Solicitor Donald Myers to make the case. A career prosecutor, Myers was determined to convict the killer who had so horrifically taunted his victim's family.
I did not like Larry Jean Bell even before I knew him. And I knew that this was probably the most publicized case that we would ever had, the most publicized in South Carolina up to that time. And I pretty much committed myself to go after him with everything I had.
Though there was powerful evidence against Bell, it was only circumstantial. Still, in the state of South Carolina, a confession could guarantee the maximum sentence. Myers needed to make sure that Bell would never be able to take another life. He wanted a confession. Again, they called on the FBI to help. They recommended setting up an interrogation room that would elicit a self-incriminating statement.
For instance, a map showing where the phone calls were made, some pictures of the victim so that he's aware as he looks about the room to remind him of the victim. You might have fingerprint cards on the table. You might have notebooks or file cabinets that would have his name on them, all to make him think you obviously have narrowed in on him, you've got the goods on him, he might as well go ahead and give it up.
While the officers prepared to question Bell, other detectives secured a search warrant for the Shepherd's house. For the next 12 hours, the forensic team combed every square inch of the home, looking for anything that would firmly connect Bell to the crimes. As the profile predicted, the house was in perfect order. It was meticulously cleaned, vacuumed, and dusted, particularly in the room where Larry Jean Bell had been staying. But beneath the orderly exterior, the team uncovered evidence of his deviance. The bed's pristine sheets concealed a thin, dirty mattress. And beneath that lay a porn magazine and a handgun that matched the description of Mr. Shepherd's missing .38. Despite the freshly vacuumed carpets, an investigator retrieved a blonde hair in the space where a vacuum cleaner wouldn't reach. A lab would match the strand to Sherry Smith.
Well, how are you this afternoon? Good to
see you here. While the investigators continued the search for evidence of the Shepherd's home, detectives at the interrogation carried out the FBI's strategy. First, they made sure Bell was comfortable. As advised by Douglas, they spoke to the suspect in a non-threatening way. They pretended to empathize with him.
Okay.
To understand his pain in order to pry him open. They walked their suspect through the growing mound of evidence condemning him. At every chance, they reminded him of the victims. Bell denied everything. However, he did make a curious request. He wanted to meet Dawn and Hilda Smith, hoping the mother and sister of his first victim might stir a confession. The Smiths agreed. Hilda and Don tried to mentally prepare themselves. Finally, they stepped into the room and came face to face with Sherry's killer.
He began to mumble and he began to speak about how he was sorry that the person sitting in that chair couldn't have been the one that had done this. But another Larry Bell could have been the one. Just, he really didn't make a lot of sense. And so I remember sitting there, I remember looking at him, I remember listening to him, and I really just felt disgust that I knew this was the man. And he wasn't even man enough to say, I did it, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to make excuses. But my mom said the most incredible thing to him. She said, I know you're the man that killed my daughter, and I can honestly say that I don't hate you. And he got teary.
But Bell's emotional break went only to the point of tears. He never made the confession authorities wanted. After weeks of compiling evidence, Myers and the investigators began to piece together the sequence of events of May 31st, 1985. Bell noticed Sherry Smith after dropping his mother off at a doctor's appointment. Something about the young woman triggered his lecherous cravings. As she left the parking lot, Bell followed. His desire shattered what little restraint he possessed. He never let her out of his sight. Sherry did not notice the car following her down the road. She pulled into the driveway and stopped at the mailbox. Bell wasted no time.
Tell me the way to.
He had taken Sherry completely by surprise.
Come on, you're going with me.
Please go.
Hey, yeah, you know, Timmy,
He brought Sherry to the Shepherd's house on Lake Murray. Bell then canceled dinner with friends. He told them he wanted to stay at the Shepherd's and watch a baseball game. He had already tied Sherry to the bed. The evidence showed that Sherry had been raped. Before killing her, Bell coerced Sherry to write her last will and testament. 12 hours after she disappeared, he covered her mouth with duct tape and suffocated her. Investigators believed that she was dead by 4:58 a.m., the time Bell claimed that their souls became one. It took less than 1 hour for 12 South Carolinians to find Bell guilty of first-degree murder. Myers prosecuted Bell in a separate trial for the murder of 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick. He was found guilty a second time. With Bell's conviction, the Smith family could begin to rebuild their lives.
There was a sense of relief that, okay, now he can't do this to me, he can't do this to anybody else, and he will be put away.
Larry Jean Bell paid the ultimate price for his sadistic crimes. On October 4th, 1996, he was put to death in South Carolina's electric chair. Though the loss of Sherry Smith and Deborah Mae Helmick will always be felt, life in Lexington has slowly returned to normal. With skill and determination, the South Carolina law enforcement community and the FBI brought closure to a grieving town by ending the deadly game of cat and mouse. A nightmare strikes, ripping a Dallas family apart. A father makes a desperate escape, while his wife and child are taken by a drug dealer. FBI agents race against time to find the hostages and their abductor. A trail of bodies litters the path to Gino Camacho.
A mother and child are kidnapped. A bystander is murdered. Violence such as this shattered a quiet Texas neighborhood and exposed a drug cartel that flourished where it was least expected. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. FBI field agents work to penetrate the secretive drug underworld, expose those involved, and crush the cartel.
In the spring of 1988, narcotics had infiltrated the working class communities of Dallas, Texas. A rise in robberies and break-ins followed the drug trade. Some families retreated from the higher crime areas to the neighborhood of Pleasant Grove. Sam Wright, his three-year-old son Andre, and his wife Evelyn Banks found refuge among the porch-lined streets. Here, residents looked out for one another. Then, early on May 20th, 1988, a gunshot shattered the morning silence. Through the shock of one onlooker, four armed men emerged from the Wright house, dragging the family to a car. Sam Wright managed to break free from the abductors and escaped. The neighbor who witnessed the incident ran to alert the authorities, while Wright dashed behind houses to avoid the gang. But help could not arrive before the gang stuffed Wright's family into the car and disappeared. Strangely, detectives had still not heard from Wright. And the mystery of the morning's events deepened as detectives entered. Inside, the kidnapping investigation expanded to include a murder investigation as well. The police found the body of a young man lying face down in a pool of blood. A driver's license identified the victim as 25-year-old David Wilburn. Investigators were thorough and collected anything that seemed promising. But there was little evidence to collect. They also dusted for fingerprints, but retrieved none foreign to the residence. Detectives spoke to the neighbor who'd called 911, hoping she could provide some answers. The interview revealed that Wilburn, the dead man found at the scene, was Sam Wright's nephew. But she didn't know why anyone would want Wilburn executed. Detectives also learned that the Latino man who drove the Lincoln had visited Sam Wright on previous occasions. But no one recognized the others. For investigators, larger questions remained. Where was Sam Wright? And why hadn't he contacted authorities about his family's abduction? Just one disturbing fact was clear. A mother and her three-year-old son were in the hands of killers. Given the urgency, the Dallas police called in the FBI. Special Agent Jose Figueroa was assigned to the case.
Every time we receive information about kidnappings, that's a priority case in our standards, especially when a kid is involved. And we don't wait 24 hours to respond to a kidnapping.
Figueroa began by searching for Sam Wright, the man who had escaped from the gang. The FBI learned that Wright was a fugitive, on the run for 3 years after fleeing a drug conviction. This explained why Wright, the distraught father, had kept on running and not turned to the police. But the FBI agents needed him. If they were going to move forward and help the wife and child, they had to talk to Wright. Suspecting that Wright was hiding in the area, agents canvassed the Pleasant Grove neighborhood, talking to neighbors.
That's what we did at the beginning. We inundated the whole area with our business cards and interviewed everybody, just asking for somebody to get in touch with Sam Wright for him to contact the FBI office.
As hoped, one of Figueroa's business cards found its way into Wright's hands. The panic-stricken father risked capture by calling the FBI. He asked for the only person who could help his family, Agent Figueroa. Tass Bailey worked with Jose Figueroa on the FBI Violent Crimes Unit in Dallas.
Sam told Jose that the individual who committed this offense was a guy named Gino, and that was all that Sam knew him by, was Gino, but that he had been arrested several months before by the Mesquite Police Department for a murder committed down in the valley, the Rio Grande Valley.
Sam Wright refused to come to the FBI office, but promised to call again. Until then, the agents had one lead, the name Gino.
We went out to the Mesquite Police Department and met with Captain Larry Sprague. Larry told us, he said, "Oh, I know exactly who you're talking about. You're talking about Gino Camacho."
33-year-old Gino Camacho was a known drug runner whose large shipments of marijuana were distributed and protected by a small gang of thugs. He was also known to have a girlfriend named Wanda Jackson. On Sunday, May 22nd, just 2 days after the abduction, agents tracked down Wanda Jackson. They asked her about Gino Camacho's whereabouts, but she denied having any knowledge of where the suspect was. She claimed that she hadn't seen Gino in weeks. The agents left with the suspicion that she was lying. If the FBI had Wright in custody, perhaps they could have negotiated a deal with Wanda as a go-between, letting Camacho believe he would be paid for his hostages. But the agents lacked the leverage that may have encouraged her to work with them. They needed to bring in Sam Wright. When Wright called the next day, they were ready with a tap and trace on the phone.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
An arrest team had already been dispatched to the downtown area.
What does he look like?
Come on, man, I don't have time to talk. Come on, put somebody on there.
You know his name?
When the payphone address came through, it was radioed to the field. The agents found Wright still using the phone, but they did not move in immediately. Though desperate to find his family, Sam Wright was a convicted drug dealer, a fugitive from the law. The FBI didn't know how far he might go to avoid capture. Agents spotted one man waiting in the car for the fugitive. Wright could have had others posted nearby. The agents wanted to reduce the risk of violent resistance by Wright and any of his associates.
Okay, here we go.
When they were confident that Wright and his driver had no other accomplices, the agents struck.
FBI, out of the car!
Wright was arrested without incident on his outstanding warrant and taken into custody. Agents Bailey and Figueroa began the interrogation of the captured fugitive.
What's your tie-in with Gino?
I don't have a tie-in.
Wright described the events of May 20th, 1988. It was any family's worst nightmare. On that day, Wright kept his young son Andre entertained. His wife, Evelyn, sat alone downstairs. They were in mourning. Wright's mother had recently passed away in Louisiana. He was expecting his nephew, David Wilburn, to arrive shortly and drive the family to the funeral. Wright watched for Wilburn's arrival since visitors did not have access to the front door. As a fugitive, Wright had installed burglar bars around the porch, thinking it would protect his family, both from the law and from his violent associates. But the bars could not withstand Gino Camacho's anger. Without warning, four men burst into the house brandishing automatic weapons. Sam Wright's past had caught up with him. The one he knew as Gino screamed that he wanted money that was owed him. Wright swore he didn't have it and pleaded for mercy. Gino's rage only escalated. At that moment, Wright's nephew, David Wilburn, arrived. He could not have come at a worse time. Though he was a large man, Gino's men quickly subdued him. Wright described his nephew as a gentle soul who never hurt anyone. Gino yelled that he meant business. To prove his point, he placed the muzzle of a .357 revolver to the back of Wilburn's head. A second later, a single shot brought instant death. Wright watched helplessly as the lifeless body of his nephew collapsed a few feet away.
The number. What's the number?
Sam Wright desperately wanted to help authorities, but he swore he didn't have any more information that could assist the investigators in locating his family. While Wright remained in custody, the clock continued ticking for his wife and son. To expedite leads, Dallas police and the FBI orchestrated a media campaign. Area newspapers and television stations featured pictures of Camacho's face. The authorities requested that citizens come forward with any information as to the suspect's whereabouts. This campaign yielded a tip from an unsavory source, another drug dealer. David Munoz, a small-time dealer, called the FBI and was connected to Agent Bailey. Munoz claimed that he recognized the kidnapper in a television news story. He said he had information that might be useful to the investigation.
You call my office?
Munoz arranged to meet Bailey in his Dallas motel late at night. He told Bailey that he knew who Camacho's accomplices were. He even offered to turn Camacho over to the FBI as part of an unorthodox deal.
What Munoz planned on doing was kind of taking over the collection of Camacho's drug debts and business dealings, and wanted us to kind of turn a blind eye towards this. We basically told him no deal.
Because there was only a weak connection to the case, Bailey did not arrest Munoz. Nevertheless, the FBI agent managed to extract one key name from the opportunist, Eddie Blaine Cummings. On the street, Cummings was known as Fast Eddie. A background check revealed he had a criminal record and had spent time in jail with Gino Camacho. Cummings was currently on parole for possession of illegal weapons. Special Agent Figueroa now had two names, Gino Camacho and Fast Eddie, as he canvassed area nightclubs. Armed with photos of Camacho and Fast Eddie, Figueroa found a bar patron who had recently seen the pair come in. The patron had heard Fast Eddie talk about a lunch appointment the next day up in Lawton, Oklahoma. A three-hour drive northwest of Dallas. An arrest team assembled in the parking lot of the Oklahoma restaurant on the morning of August 12, 1988. The plan was to wait until Fast Eddie exited the crowded restaurant to isolate him from bystanders. Investigators were poised to strike. Fast Eddie was their closest link to Camacho so far. When the door opened, the arrest team descended, nabbing Fast Eddie before he could flee. One associate of Camacho's gang was now in custody. Agents hoped Fast Eddie could lead them closer to the missing mother and son. In the summer of 1988, Dallas FBI agents searched for a missing mother and child, abducted at gunpoint by a drug gang. Fast Eddie, an associate of the gang, was now in custody. Under interrogation, Fast Eddie denied having anything to do with the kidnapping in Dallas.
Come on, Eddie, the kidnapping at the Wright house.
But eventually, he did tell them what he knew of the crime.
This was the first time we had actually learned who all was involved and the names of the individuals the morning of the abduction.
Fast Eddie fingered Camacho and two other gang members, Juan Jackson and David Cook. He and David Cook had grown up together in Stephenville, Texas, a two-hour drive from Dallas. As far as Fast Eddie knew, Cook was probably back in their hometown. Bailey and Figueroa needed to get Cook, trusting that the lead might take them one step closer to Camacho and the missing mother and child. They sought a contact in Stephenville and found the name of Detective Don Miller. On August 15th, 1988, Detective Don Miller called back Agent Bailey. Miller had found the suspect working at his family's convenience store. The detective would hold him until the agents arrived.
You're waiting on you.
Miller warned Cook that if he knew something, it would be best to cooperate with the FBI.
Yeah, you boys.
One member of the gang that kidnapped Evelyn and Andre Banks was now in custody. The FBI was a step closer to Camacho and the missing pair. Agents rushed to Stephenville, hoping David Cook may lead them to Camacho and his hostages before time ran out for the mother and son.
That's a couple of months ago.
He had decided to help investigators with the case in the hopes of a lighter sentence. Over 2 days of interrogation, Cook detailed his version of the events of May 20th, 1988. On the morning of the assault, Camacho picked up Cook and two more associates. He said they were going to collect a debt. Camacho had given Sam Wright $20,000 worth of marijuana to deal, but Wright had claimed it was stolen. Camacho swore he'd get his money back. Gang member Juan Jackson opened up a bag and started passing out guns. The arsenal included submachine guns and the .357 pistol. Camacho sent another gang member, Larry Merrill, around back to cut the phone line. No one was going to call for help. Juan Jackson cut through the padlocked burglar bars, while David Cook and Camacho kept watch. They burst in the front door and found Evelyn Banks in the living room. Camacho had his men sweep the house, guns drawn.
Where's my money? Where's my money? Where's my 20 grand? Chest this. Move.
Move.
The gang corralled the terrified family into the living room as Camacho's fury rose. He said that if the family didn't cooperate, they would die.
Camacho told him to put the baby on the sofa next to his mother, and that if the baby moved or caused any problems, to shoot him. Gino started screaming how they had ripped him off, how they had not treated him with respect, and he wanted his money and he wanted it now.
Amid all the shouting, there came a knock at the door. The assailant's first thought was that the neighbors had summoned the police. Camacho and Jackson moved into position, prepared to fire on the police they thought were on the other side of the door. When David Wilburn walked through the front door, he was surrounded by the armed gang. The gunman threw him to the ground without a struggle. Camacho ordered Jackson to shoot him. But when he hesitated, Camacho turned to Cook. But when Cook refused, Camacho grabbed the gun from his hand and showed everyone just how serious he was.
No! Get out of here, let's go.
Camacho yelled that no one was going to show him disrespect anymore.
Grab my gun and he just blows the guy away.
Under intense questioning, Cook never wavered on the facts, including that Camacho was the shooter. His story matched Sam Wright's version. After they left the house, Camacho remained furious that Wright had escaped. But the gang didn't give chase. They knew the police would soon be summoned in force to the Pleasant Grove neighborhood. Instead, Camacho ordered them all to Cook's apartment, where he could decide their next move. Camacho figured they could lay low there with the hostages. Paul Macaluso was the assistant U.S. attorney who tracked the case.
They were concerned about damage control. They had two witnesses to a murder, to a capital murder, and what to do about them.
Cook told agents that a new gang member, Spencer Stanley, was called to the apartment to guard the hostages while he and Camacho were away dealing drugs at a nearby hotel. Juan Jackson didn't stay much longer. Fearing the heat from the authorities, he cleaned the guns, took some getaway cash, and left the gang for good. While Stanley kept watch over the hostages, Cook and Camacho drove to the hotel to make the drug deal. There, just 2 days after the abduction, Camacho got a call from his girlfriend, Wanda Jackson. She had a cryptic message for him.
Hey, your big brother was just here? Yeah.
Big brother, of course, referring to the federal authorities, the FBI, had been to the house.
The same girlfriend that had sworn to the FBI that she had no idea of Camacho's whereabouts reached him moments after the agents left her.
In trouble. I don't know how.
Her warning gave the gang a head start on the pursuing agents. Camacho returned to Cook's apartment. He told Evelyn that he wasn't angry with her, only with her husband over the money.
I'm not after you.
He said he would release her and Andre if she promised not to go to the authorities.
The man owed me the money.
She agreed.
Throw you around the way I did.
With that pledge, Camacho said he would take them to a private airstrip in Oklahoma for a flight to California. There they would remain safe until Camacho settled up with Wright. At the end of a grueling interrogation session, Cook told agents that Evelyn and Andre never made it to California. There was no plane for them to board. Cook knew where they were left, across the Texas state line, near Ardmore, Oklahoma.
Turn around, hands right here.
In August of 1988, special agents from Dallas's Violent Crimes Unit had arrested one member of a Texas gang responsible for one murder and the abduction of a mother and child. While in custody, Cook pointed special agents Jose Figueroa and Tass Bailey north to Oklahoma. It was the next stepping stone towards their ultimate goal, finding Evelyn and Andre Banks and their abductor, Gino Camacho. According to Cook, Camacho had driven Evelyn and Andre Banks to a remote area across state lines. The gang leader had promised to fly the mother and child to her relatives in California from an airstrip that was concealed behind the trees. They pulled the car off the side of the road and together headed into the woods. Spencer Stanley led the way, carrying 3-year-old Andre. In a few hours, she thought she would be on the West Coast, where she would remain until her husband paid the drug debt he owed Camacho. But as they walked deeper into the woods, Evelyn found no clearing for a plane to land. Then she saw the hole.
No!
In an instant, she realized what it meant. She fainted from the shock. There was no airstrip, no flight to freedom. She and her son had been brought here to die. Spencer Stanley dropped her child into the open grave. Camacho fired 4 times. Then they threw Evelyn in on top of her son and shot her as well. Evelyn Banks and her 3-year-old son, Andre, died on May 23rd, 1988. This was the grisly scene that David Cook told agents he was leading them to. The agents had just about reached their frustration point when Cook at last recognized the area. The search for Camacho's victims began in the punishing heat of late summer. The federal kidnapping case had escalated into a homicide case as well. Camacho had now killed 3 people. But if the agents wanted to prove their case against the killer, they had to find the bodies. To pinpoint the burial site, the agents began a line search through the trees.
And as we walked in behind those cedar trees, you could see a depression in the ground where someone had dug. All the sod had been torn off.
When investigators reached the site, 3 months had passed since the murders. They began the painstaking excavation. They removed small loads and sifted through the dirt, careful not to miss or destroy any evidence. Near the surface, agents found shell casings from a .380 caliber weapon.
Yeah, somebody got a bag?
That fit with Cook's account that Camacho had fired a small semi-automatic pistol.
Right there.
The digging continued at a painfully slow pace.
Like they've all been here about the same time.
You got to remember, this is the end of August. It was about 95 degrees, about 90% humidity. We were in that area of the trees, so there was no air movement. I mean, we were just stuck in there. We'd been digging for about 2 hours.
Then one of the agents struck something hard. It sounded hollow. Another blow broke through the shell-like crust. A foul stench suddenly overwhelmed the agents.
And the god-awful smell of decaying human body came out of the hole, and we both jumped out of the hole and went over in the bushes and got sick, and then had to go back into it again.
Before burying Evelyn and Andre, Camacho and his men covered the bodies with cat litter to help hide the odor. But the clay in the cat litter absorbed moisture from the bodies, then hardened into an airtight shell, reducing the rate of decomposition and preserving the bodies for autopsy. Despite the nauseating stench, the agents pressed on. They put Vicks Vapor Rub under their noses to suppress the odor and continued working. They were determined to construct an impenetrable case against Camacho and his gang. Cook then led agents to nearby Lake Texoma, where he said the gang had disposed of the weapons after the killing. A dive team from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation combed the lake bottom. They came up with more casings from the .380. And then they found the handgun. The physical evidence against Gino Camacho was now solid, corroborating eyewitness testimony. The federal agents were confident they could secure a conviction on 2 counts of kidnapping and 3 of murder. But Camacho remained at large, and agents learned he had killed again. Cook told the FBI he could lead them to that body as well. In late August of 1988, the FBI in Dallas had captured David Cook, a member of a violent Texas drug gang. The gang's leader, Gino Camacho, wanted for kidnapping and 3 murders, was still at large. Cook was cooperating with agents in the hunt for Camacho. He had led investigators to the burial site of Camacho's most recent murder victims. But during the 2-day trip to recover the bodies of Evelyn and Andre Banks in Oklahoma, Cook surprised agents with another tale of Camacho's terror. This time, Camacho had released his rage on a woman named Pamela Miller. Agents now turned their focus to her whereabouts. Agents learned that Pam Miller worked as an exotic dancer in a Dallas strip club. She met Camacho and started hanging out with his gang. Cook told agents that he and Miller joined Camacho one night in June of 1988.
So you're off with
all set.
And still looking for
it had been just 3 weeks since Camacho had shot and killed 3 people, but he had risked a trip to Dallas to arrange another drug deal.
Only about 5 minutes, all right.
The buyer showed up at a hotel bar and began negotiating.
take care of him. Yeah.
But Pam interrupted the transaction.
Pam Miller recognized the purchaser as somebody who came into the club where she had danced, and she recognized him and she told him so. I know you, you came into the club. Well, not surprisingly, this had a chilling effect on the transaction.
Sure.
The buyer skipped out. The deal was dead.
You have any idea what you just did?
I know him from where I dance at.
You do?
Camacho became furious at Pam for messing up the drug deal. And Cook and Pam and Camacho walked out of the hotel. As soon as they got in the car, Camacho started beating Pamela. Pamela then made some comments to Camacho attacking his manhood, which only infuriated him more.
Yes, huh? Yes, you did. You lost me.
As they drove, Camacho's rage boiled over. Cook and Stanley had seen the results of his temper before. They knew where it could lead. Yet they were too intimidated to speak up. Camacho's brutal beating didn't stop until Miller had lost consciousness.
Stop the car!
Still enraged, Camacho ordered Cook to stop the car. He dragged Miller onto the road, laid her limp body behind the right rear tire, and yelled for Cook to back up.
Come on, Gino, I don't want... Back the car! Now!
Cook obeyed.
They drove down to Stephenville. They went to an apartment that was rented by David Cook, and they took Pamela's body and put it in a 55-gallon drum, stuck it out on the patio, stuck a bag of trash on top of it so no one would see there was a body in it.
They stayed there for the weekend. Camacho, Stanley, Cook. They sat around drinking beer and partying until Camacho decided to dispose of the body.
So we asked David, well, where will we find Pamela's body? And he said, you won't. And we said, why not? He said, well, we chopped her up and put her in a tree mulcher. While I was driving the car, Jose was in the front seat. I looked at Jose, he looked at me, our mouths dropped open, and I almost ran off the highway. I couldn't believe what I just heard.
Cook led FBI agents to the wooded site on the ranch where they had pulverized the body. It seemed impossible that they would find any remains. Not only would the shredder have pulped the body, but it was now some 2 months after the insidious act. It was likely that the hot Texas sun had decayed the remains even further. Despite the odds, agents set out to recover what they could. From Cook's account, the agents figured out the shredder's discharge path. They set up a grid system and began meticulously scouring the scene. The process took hours, but the hard work yielded dividends. From the ground, agents recovered bone shards and tissue. In the tree branches above, they found more tissue dried by the sun. Each item was bagged and labeled based on its location. The agents also recovered teeth. A check with Pamela Miller's dental records allowed a positive identification of the victim. 23-year-old Pamela Miller had been Camacho's fourth murder in as many weeks. Yet her murderer was still at large, and every day he remained free, Camacho posed a threat to anyone that crossed his path. But a major break in the case soon followed when the family of Spencer Stanley, the gang member who had helped Camacho kill three victims, contacted the FBI. They tipped the agents off that Stanley was hiding in a trailer park in Huntsville, Alabama. Stanley told investigators that he had thrown the .357 Camacho used to kill David Wilburn into Lake Ray Hubbard near Dallas. An FBI dive team searched the bottom of the Texas lake. They never found a gun. But they did find a casing from a .357 and several live rounds. The recovered bullets were taken to the FBI's Materials and Devices Unit in Washington, D.C. for neutron activation analysis. Agents hoped that the bullets from Lake Ray Hubbard could be matched to the bullet that killed Camacho's first victim, David Wilburn. Neutron activation analysis is based on the fact that lead bullets are created in batches, and each batch of lead is unique. The FBI examiners needed to prepare the bullets for the test by removing the slugs from the shells, readying them for transportation to a nuclear reactor. Lead samples from each bullet were lowered into the reactor's core. The samples absorbed neutrons and became radioactive. The radioactivity was measured and gave a precise reading of the chemical elements found in the lead, a radioactive signature. Examiners concluded that the signatures from each bullet were identical. The bullets from Lake Ray Hubbard and Wilburn's body had come from the same batch of ammunition. Though the physical evidence against Camacho continued to build, it didn't put the authorities any closer to locating the fugitive. Through an informant, the FBI learned that Camacho had escaped to Mexico and was hiding in a small town just south of the Texas border. U.S. authorities sought to have him arrested and extradited. But Mexican authorities were unable to cooperate. They claimed that the town where Camacho stayed was controlled by drug kingpins who were heavily armed. If the Mexican police attempted an arrest, there would be heavy casualties. The FBI would need another plan to bring the gang leader to justice. After four murders in the U.S., drug dealer Gino Camacho had escaped to Mexico, out of reach of the FBI. But without his gang or the drug trade that had supported them, his money began to run out. By the spring of 1989, Camacho was in desperate need of cash. He still had suppliers in Mexico, if he could locate a buyer in the States. Because he feared crossing back into the U.S., he searched for a middleman with narcotics distribution contacts north of the border. The low-level go-between Camacho stumbled upon worked as an informant for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. The informant reported to his DEA handler that a man named Gino wanted to set up a drug deal. DEA agent John Lunt was based in Fort Worth, Texas. He was aware that Gino Camacho was wanted by the FBI.
What you got for me?
You're Gino.
Suspecting that this Gino was Gino Camacho, Lunt told his informant that he wanted to go ahead with the deal. Lunt then called FBI agent Tass Bailey with good news.
John told me that it sounded like this was Gino Camacho. I then provided John with a photograph of Camacho, which he showed to his informant, and the informant confirmed that that, in fact, was the individual with whom he had met.
To get the fugitive across the border, the FBI offered Camacho a deal he couldn't refuse. Their informant told Camacho that an American distributor wanted to buy $1 million worth of marijuana. But the distributor needed to finalize the deal in person. He wasn't comfortable doing such a large deal with someone he'd never met. To calm Camacho's fears about entering the U.S., the informant told Camacho the distributor would advance Gino $100,000 when they met in the border town of McAllen, Texas. But there was one problem with this deal. Field agents needed a means of visually identifying the fugitive amongst other border crossers. To make Camacho stand out, the informant sent clothes he said would enable the distributor to identify him. The arrest team committed the clothing to memory, Hawaiian shirt, blue shorts, and a green-brimmed baseball cap. Camacho got the package of clothes at a friend's apartment where he often hung out. But no one could be sure an experienced smuggler like Camacho would not be too suspicious to wear the outfit.
We knew that this was going to be our only shot at him. that once he figured he'd been set up, that the informant would be burned and he would be even more cautious than before in doing any type of transaction that would afford us an opportunity to arrest him. So we set up very elaborate arrest plans.
On the day of the deal, agents scanned the border crossing for Camacho. They hoped they could find him in the crowd by the telltale clothes that the smuggler had been sent. Then, the arrest team spotted him in the outfit. Camacho didn't realize the place was swarming with federal agents, dressed as patrol guards, tourists, and passersby. They all had memorized the outfit and his picture. Calmly posing as a tourist, he started across the bridge that spanned the border. FBI agents dressed as Border Patrol guards approached Camacho. The fugitive played it cool and gave a false name, Tomas Sanchez. When the agents asked for identification, he claimed he didn't have any. He was simply an American tourist returning from a day trip to Mexico. The agents coolly told him to come inside for questioning. He went without a fight, believing this minor misunderstanding would soon be cleared. The gang leader was already in FBI custody, and he didn't even know it. Camacho was taken to the Border Patrol office and fingerprinted. Bailey let him stew in the cell for over 2 hours, while agents waited for a computer match on the prints. Camacho didn't break his silence.
I addressed him as Tomas Sanchez, and he acknowledged that, and I says, well, we have taken your fingerprints, we have run them through the computer at the FBI in Washington, D.C., and the computer says that you're not Tomas Sanchez, you're in fact Gino Camacho. And he said, well, if that's what the computer says, it must be so.
But Camacho denied knowing anything about the murders. To the end, he never admitted any involvement in the kidnapping and murders. He claimed the FBI had framed him for the crimes. The arrest of Gino Camacho made page one news across the Southwest. From the border, he was moved to a cell in Dallas County and charged with firearms violations, kidnapping, conspiracy, and capital murder. Camacho and the rest of his gang were prosecuted by the authorities. David Cook received 24 years for his part in the murders and kidnapping. Spencer Stanley got a life sentence for the three murders he helped carry out. Juan Jackson earned a life sentence for his involvement. Fast Eddie Cummings and Larry Merrill got 8 years each. Sam Wright had to serve his prior drug sentence as well as additional time for fugitive flight. But for Camacho himself, state prosecutors sought the death penalty. For the state of Texas to put a man to death, the prosecution must prove more than premeditation. It must show the accused remains a threat to society. For this reason, Camacho was tried on the state murder charge first. Otherwise, a conviction on the federal charges would have sent Camacho to prison, where any threat he posed to society would have been removed. In separate trials, Gino Camacho was found guilty for murder and kidnapping. The sentence was carried out 10 years after the deaths of Andre and Evelyn Banks and Pamela Miller. On August 26, 1998, the state of Texas executed Gino Camacho by lethal injection.